Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the kickoff event for Silicon Valley Reads 2016, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, Santa Clara County Library District, San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Jill Bourne, and I am the Library Director for the City of San Jose and co-chair of Silicon Valley Reads. Our theme this year is Chance of Rain, the impact of climate change on our lives. And it is my pleasure to introduce the authors of this year's Silicon Valley Reads featured books, Emmy Inaranta and Benjamin Parzbach. Moderating tonight's conversation is Mr. Sal Pizarro, columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Memory of Water is Emmy Inaranta's debut novel, and it has won several awards, including honorable mention from the 2014 James Tiptree Jr. Award jury. Translation rights to the book have been sold in 17 territories to date. Emmy grew up in Finland and holds an MA in drama from the University of Tampere and an MA in creative writing from the University of Kent. She lives in Canterbury, UK, and her second novel, The City of Woven Streets, will be published this year. Sherwood Nation is the second novel of Benjamin Parzbach, whose first book, Couch, was a two-time Indie Next pick. His short stories have been published in several magazines, and he was a co-founder of Gumball Poetry, a literary journal published in Gumball Capsule Machines. He lives in Portland, Oregon, where he is the founder of Chief Technology Officer of the startup Walker Tracker. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Emmy Inaranta and Benjamin Parzbach and Sal Pizarro.
So Ben, Emmy, thank you both for being here and part of our program. This is going to be a start to a two-month conversation we have about water here
Not
in Silicon
tonight,
Valley.
Though.
Right. This won't last for 2 months, okay. But this is just the beginning. This is the first chapter, as it were. But it's a great program, and we have an interesting theme for, of course, this area, and that's Chance of Rain. You're both here today. We had a wonderful mid-60s clear sky in the middle of January, typical Silicon Valley weather for us lately. Although we have been in an El Nino situation, which we'll always be touching upon, I think, as we talk tonight, that rain has become a, you know, when it rains, it pours issue here. We either have too little or, on occasion, too much. But let's start talking about you. It's wonderful to have you both here. I mean, you're going to have a very, I think, fascinating experience as our first author in residence spending the entire time here. And Ben, you're going to be flying in and out, but we look forward to seeing you many times. Can you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and how you got started? What drew you into writing? Emmy, can we start with you?
Yes, my background is in doing all sorts of bits and pieces of writing jobs. I have a degree in drama and I have another degree in creative writing. After my first degree, I did all sorts of things like I worked as a press officer, I worked as a critic, I worked as a journalist, but all the time, everything, all of that was sort of around the idea that I wanted to start writing fiction. And one day I just said, I'm going to do that. That's what I want to do, so that's what I'm going to do. I moved from Finland, which is where I'm originally from and where I grew up. I moved from Finland to the UK to do an MA in creative writing, and I started writing Memory of Water while doing that degree.
Wow. So that has not been a huge amount of time since you started that. Mm-hmm. Ben, what's your story?
I suppose the trajectory to becoming a writer involves many aspects. Right after my first year of college, I took 9 months off and spent most of it traveling through Central America. And I think beforehand I had kind of fancied myself a writer, but then there's really nothing like months and months of brute journaling and putting tons of words down there to really do it. But I think really the crux of it was when I was in college, I went to Evergreen State College. I don't know if any of you have heard of this, but it's a very funny alternative college up in Washington State. And I went there to get an alternative energy degree, like to specialize in alternative energy design. And at Evergreen, you have these classes where you take one class a year and it has everything in it. And in that case, it had physics and calculus and hardware hacking and all this kind of stuff. And I was pretty good in physics and not great in math. And I had gone to that college to get that degree. And when suddenly I didn't get into that class, I just totally veered off in the other direction and did a playwriting class. And was kind of stricken from then. I was like, this is perfect. Stricken in the positive way. Stricken is the negative connotation, isn't it? It was a little bit like a lightning bolt sort of moment. Anyway, yeah, and then continued on with that. Actually, for a while, I was the ghostwriter for the governor of the state of Washington.
Wow, that's...
Which is a wonderful exercise in fiction.
I want to read that book.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually my favorite part of this is not really having to do with being a writer, but he had a signature machine in his office, and it was one of these, it was like an old, I think it's called a trundle sewing machine, where you pump the foot pedal and his signature would come out, and of course, everyone I knew got letters from the governor after that. It was great. Yeah.
What a preparation for a life writing fiction. Now, speaking of fiction, your books are in this genre that's called climate fiction or eco-fiction. They both deal with this unfortunate future world where water is scarce and has become the rarest commodity. It's, money is useless. Water is what we trade in. Did you realize you were writing to this genre, and what sort of attracted you to these stories?
Yeah, I don't think I was really thinking I'm going to write eco-fiction or climate fiction or anything like that. I had an idea about a character in a future world where there was very little fresh water left, and the character and the world came first, and I didn't really think about the genre because I don't usually start from the genre. I think it's more interesting to start from the character and story, and then the genre comes after. But I did choose the topic because I was interested in climate change. I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to write it from a point of view which I felt was not particularly visible in novels at the time. I started writing Memory of Water in 2008, and there were not many books about water scarcity at that time, whereas now there are a lot.
Mm-hmm. And Ben?
I care about the science behind climate change a lot. I'm not super comfortable with the term climate fiction. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of ways both of what we've written is psychological and sociological fiction within a climatological influenced world, I guess.
That's harder to fit on a bookshelf.
It is, it's so cumbersome. Yeah. So, in fact, the seed of it was I started the book when I was living in Brazil, and I had a chance to go visit some favelas. And for those of you who don't know, a favela is like a big shanty town, and they're really prevalent in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. And they really are like enclaves. They're their own governments. The city provides them no utilities. They don't patrol them. They don't influence them with their laws, and of course, a lot of times it's chaos and it's a very difficult place to live. But in other places, and there are many different types of favelas, they have incredibly strong community organizations. There's a network of entrepreneurs, and I found this just completely fascinating. And I loved the idea of that enclave within the city, as each of them different social experiments. And I think that was some of the very early.
And I can see where it certainly took off from there for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rest of the story kind of grows around that. In reading both of your books, one of the parallels, while they're very different stories, it's kind of refreshing that they both have young women as the strong central character. And actually, there's supporting women who are supporting, who are also very strong in the books. Where did that choice come from a story point of view? How important was it for those characters to be women to serve as a story? Because I felt like, to me, they couldn't have been male characters. And it was very important for them to be women. What did you think going in?
For me, it was, I knew from the beginning that I wanted to write a woman's story. And I think it connected with, because I also know very early on that I wanted to write a story about where one of the themes was rewriting and changing history, erasing things. And I think that women's histories are, tend to disappear a lot more often than men's. So I wanted to write about a female character because I wanted to write about a character whose story would not make it to the official history books, but would disappear instead. Because I'm interested in those lost stories, the stories mm-hmm. that we do not hear. So I think that was, for me, the main core of why I chose to write about a female character. But I also felt that we have, also in fiction, not just in history, but also in fiction, we already have lots of stories about male characters. So for me, it was an obvious choice to write about a woman.
Okay. And Ben, what did
it, if I could add slightly to yours, I also thought in your book it was very interesting how two of the other main characters, the mother and her best friend, were already doing some role reversal, and yet it was her job in sort of the ritualistic that was sort of forbidden for women to enter. It was an interesting choice. For me, I think during my time, during my book, I was really frustrated with politics. Unlike now, I mean, it's, everything's hunky-dory. So part of that was, I mean, one thing that I wanted to play with was the idea of whether democracy could really ably handle times of extreme crises. And then the other thing is I just sort of felt like having a woman be in charge, having that role reversal there was just sort of an obvious conclusion for a book that wanted to challenge all those other pieces of politics as well. Yeah, it felt like an obvious choice to me. I felt like I could get behind her as a character most.
And you do have a lot of role reversal because you have the Zach character, the boyfriend, who in many another novel would be the girlfriend. But he, you know, he plays a very supportive, you know, role, but he doesn't really emerge into the central character the way Renee does. And and at the beginning of the book, I don't know, you know, in the first chapter, you don't know where it's going to go. Whose story is this? And then it quickly becomes, oh, this isn't Zach's story, this is Renee's story.
Yeah.
Now, you've got a lot of other wonderful characters. You guys both draw some interesting characters and some really nasty authority figures. Both of you, I mean, it's like, boy, what did the mayor of Portland ever do to you, Ben? I mean, but, and some of the other strong characters are also funny and engaging. Were there some favorites for you to write, some voices you were very happy to get into, and also think about who was the most difficult for you to really tap into as a character? Ben, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I loved writing the mayor.
I think it shows, actually.
I partially loved him because he was nasty, but I also loved partially that I didn't think that at his core he was nasty. He was not always nasty. He was partially nasty by power and circumstance, and I found that really entertaining to write because I do feel like he's got a bit of an arc in there, and a bit of redemption at the end. Yeah.
Well, he's a character who wants to be effective, which I think is the Is Jason Baker still here? You know, in terms of, well, in government, you know, people get into government because they want to be effective, and then they find themselves at times being very ineffective, and it frustrates them, and then they lash out, and then they might get shot in the leg. Spoiler.
Yeah, and in our system, you have to, because of an election cycle, you have a, I mean, I think there's a cycle to every politician where there's a point where you are at maximum effectiveness, and then there's a part where you have to think about your ability to be reelected again, which probably does not necessarily coincide perfectly with maximum effectiveness. So.
Mm-hmm. Emmy, was there anyone whose skin you particularly enjoyed being
Yes, I actually loved writing my main villain, who is a sort of military official, Taro, who is very ambitious and I loved writing him because I thought that he in some ways was Nori as the main character's sort of dark reflection. He's got a very similar starting point in life as my main character Noria does, but he makes completely different choices along the way. So I thought that he was a very interesting character to write. I really enjoyed it. I don't like the character at all. I wouldn't want to, you know, be in the same room with him ever, but writing him was a lot of fun, actually.
You can see that. Mm. And you know, and you, the other characters, I also really enjoy Noria's mother. Mm. Is a fascinating character, and her story and the things she does, you know, to sort of both save herself and her family.
Yeah, she's actually the character that I get asked about more often. She's the character that some readers seem to struggle to understand her mm-hmm. choices. They don't understand why she does the way she does them. To me, it's obvious, but it may not be obvious to all readers. She remains a little bit cryptic, I suppose, in some ways.
I think there's, in the book, in Memory of Water, there's a much closer connection, certainly at first, between Noria and her father.
Yes.
And the mother comes off very much as the outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, why is she kind of here? And then, you know, the plot changes and the relationships change.
Mm.
And did you at all struggle with where her character was going?
Yes, I actually think that Noria's mother was the most difficult character to write. I kind of knew what she had to do in the story, but it was sometimes difficult for me to find the logic and reason mm-hmm. for why she was doing these things. So I can see that for some readers that might also be a little bit difficult.
I could see her path going a number of ways, yeah. Potentially, and we know where it ended up. If you finish the books, but you still have time. Interestingly, tea has a very important place in both books. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's much more central in yours, but Ben, there's a tea ceremony that takes place in your book with the character Gregor. It's very important to him. And you realize the connection between tea and water, I think, more than almost any other beverage. It sort of comes clear in both books. Where did that come from for both of you? How did the tea develop as an important element?
It's funny because we talked about this backstage for a moment, and I really wanted to hear what you were going to say about it, and then we got interrupted. But so I felt like my feeling was that you had something to say about it that was kind of smarter than what I'm going to say about it. So overwrite that in your mind when Salsa says. But essentially, my character Gregor, really, first of all, he's in a position of power, and he uses tea to sort of reset a relationship and to create a ritual around something that not only is, you know, acknowledges that it is, we are contained both of tea water, and a ritual around something that is a scarcity. And then he's got a little bit of family tie to it as well. But that ritual especially took on a lot of meaning in a society where you are really partaking in a ritual that is the foundation of your economic system as well as your lifeblood.
For me, tea became central in the book because at the time when I started writing it, I was very interested in Japanese tea culture. They have this thing that they call the way of tea. Tea ceremony is actually an erroneous Western translation. They call it shado, which is the way of tea, which is considered an art form. And I was very interested in that. And I was doing also research on other Asian tea cultures, and then I came across this idea that in China in particular, the quality of water was considered very important for the tea. Mm-hmm. And in Japanese tea culture, the tea, well, in China as well, tea used to be a sort of expensive luxury product that a lot of people could not afford. So the tea ceremony at some point was kind of exclusive. And I had this idea of what if there was a future world where people were still practicing these old tea rituals, but the expensive luxury product would not be tea, it would be fresh water instead. And that's sort of where something clicked, and I knew that I had the beginning of the story there. And when I realized this importance of what water means for tea, I felt that tea became an important motive that I could use in a story to tell things about water and imagine a society and world where there were shortages of water and what it would be like.
And you, class and etiquette, too.
Exactly. I mean, it's clear that there's a lot of research that went into both of your books. And because you do a lot of world building. You've got places that really don't exist right now, although your Portland doesn't exist at the moment. But what was it like to create these worlds? Did you put a lot of research into what might happen in an extreme situation like you were both dealing with, or was a lot of it just imagination? I mean, you clearly had to think about where your novel was happening, and yours was also very geographically important. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, the majority of my research probably went into stuff like emergency rationing after a disaster, to looking historically at dictators and how dictators have done. I find that a fascinating topic because we have an extremely negative connotation with the word dictator, and the original word was from Latin, and it was when the Roman Empire was suffering times of extreme duress, the Congress would vote in a dictator to help them through trials, usually invasions by Germanic tribes, to get through that, and then the dictator would step down and they would move on. And there have been also dictators like Mustafa Atatürk, who completely revolutionized Turkish society and brought secularism and education and civil rights to that society in a time where that was completely unheard of. But there's very tricky dictators, obviously, as well. I've forgotten the question.
The question was a lot of research, a lot of imagination,
yes.
In building the world.
Okay. I also, so when you're writing, I mean, this was a particular pleasure for me. I love Portland, Oregon. I suppose that the book, in a way, was a love letter, if a bit of a rancorous love letter, in which I got to destroy parts of it. Mm-hmm. And I love authors who create real places, or rather utilize real places, and then just imbue them with tons of meaning. And I feel like every time I walk by the landmarks in my book, they resonate more. And I hope that's like that for other Portlanders as well. So.
I'll never visit Portland and look at it the same way. Like, I'm afraid to cross that street. There might be a tunnel under there.
That's right.
So what was it like for you? Because in addition to just building a different society, you're a little bit farther ahead in the future. His is still rooted in the culture we have now, but you had to create an entirely different culture.
That's right. Yes, my research was mainly, obviously, about the impact that climate change is likely to have on freshwater resources. But I also did research. I I felt that in order to make that future world credible, I had to make everything kind of grow organically from the premise of there isn't a lot of water. So it was important for me to get the geography right. I did a lot of research on how different the map would look if the sea levels were to rise by 40 or 50 meters, which is what would happen if all the ice melted. So I sort of went with a very extreme scenario, which is not likely to happen in the next 200 years, but is probably farther ahead in the future. But I wanted to get those details right, so I had this map for myself where I could see how different the world will look. All the plants mentioned in the book are crops which are drought resistant, because I wanted that to be credible. There are not a lot of animals in memory of water, because the expectation is that quite a few species will actually go extinct due to climate change. So I did quite a lot of research. Of course, there are lots of things that are completely imaginary as well, but it was important for me with the world building to try to make it consistent, I wanted everything to have roots in present day and what could potentially happen. I'm not saying that's the future we necessarily face, but I wanted the reader to be able to think this could happen.
I think it was very effective, actually. And I did love the plastic grave is one of my favorite locations in your book. Just this idea of thinking about, you know, the places that we have left our things and and what becomes of them, and ages from now, what people will think of what's left, what people find our little water bottles
exactly.
And wonder what we did with them.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's nice that we have water. Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to the sociological idea that we touched on before, your books treat the concept of man versus nature in interesting ways. I felt like Sherwood Nation looked at man as being very helpless against nature. What was happening, the drought, the government was ineffective, even ultimately to some degree, the Maid Marian and what she was doing was ineffective. The only thing that was going to make anything change was if it rained. And in Memory of Water, you get I was left with the impression that, you know, a person could be in harmony with nature, but once you get people involved, they can be destructive. And in some ways, it's kind of a bleak outlook for society. Did you have any thoughts on what you wanted people to take from these books in terms of changing their habits, perhaps, or thinking about our resources and our relationship with nature in a different way than we probably do now as a society?
Well, yes, I mean,
that's the deep question, by the way.
Yeah, I definitely did kind of want to give the readers something to think about. But I also kind of feel like I'm preaching to the converted, that the people who will pick up Memory of Water are already the kind of people who think about these things anyway. But Memory of Water is very much about, it's very much a coming of age story. It's about someone having to grow up, and part of that growing up is learning to take the responsibility, not just for yourself, but for other people, for the community around you, and by extension, the environment. That's something that I wanted to be at the very core of the story. There are other things there as well, but that's definitely one of the main themes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. I suppose the short answer is, do I want people to feel thirsty as they read the book? And the answer would be yes. I was particularly intrigued by the idea of droughts, because I think a drought, like climate change, happens outside of humans' ability to really understand time-wise. Mm-hmm. They're very slow moving. They're very difficult to plan for. They're very difficult to be effective of in the middle of them. By the time you realize, especially because you never know when they'll end or when they'll change, and by the time you're deep in, it might be too late for some of the actions that you perhaps should have taken at the very beginning. Very different than a massive snowstorm, for example, or a hurricane, or a forest fire, something like that, where the entire community can pitch in and band together and do incredible work and rebuild, and some lives were lost, but we're moving on. And whereas a drought and climate change are, they move at a pace that is not really recognizable to our sense of time. So I think I really wanted to play with that and so that people did think about that and consider the kinds of changes that one might need to make in a really long-term sense, but mostly just to play with the idea itself that we are here for such short amount of time. I was talking to somebody earlier just about how culturally California has changed in the last 20 years or so, and it's just it's remarkable how short of a time we've been here, and yet these weather cycles and climate cycles happen in these giant arcs, which we're just totally unprepared for and don't really understand. So, yeah.
Did writing the books, you know, this experience, did it change how you personally connected with water? Did you think about water and weather in a different way after you were done? Did that last?
For me, to some extent, yes, because I grew up in Finland, which has large freshwater resources. I've always taken water for granted. I never had to think about my water consumption before. When I started researching for this book, I did start paying attention to it. I mean, I live in the UK where we have nothing but rain, so I still don't particularly need to think about how much water I use. But it's something that I'm much more aware of now. I've tried to probably make some small changes in my everyday life to be a bit more responsible.
This is sort of a horrible story, during the middle of the book, I was really, the premise is that really only after the second chapter, the rations are cut to a gallon a day per person. There's slight allowances for families and stuff like that, but I had a family at my disposal. And so I asked my kids and my wife to see if we could all live on a gallon each a day, and I wasn't very popular.
How long did that experiment last?
Oh, it's probably a day and a half.
And what could you do with a gallon of water a day?
Well, you have to, I mean, that's kind of the amazing thing about it, because you kind of have to share in that, like, oh, okay, we're going to cook beans, so everybody needs to give a portion of their water to cook the beans, and, you know, who gets to bathe today? It's going to have to be a sponge. The kids were like, oh, that's no problem with us. And then you think of, like, oh, house plants, you know, how would this work over a long term, and we've got a cat, and, yeah, it was tricky.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that Emmy mentioned, yeah, there's no animals, or there's very few in the memory of water, because that would not be a priority. It would, and species would be competitive. Mm-hmm. And I think the same would eventually happen in your Portland if things continued along the path they are at the beginning of the book. So another thing that your books have in common is water crime. There's water crime is a factor. And here in California, we've had 4 years of drought. We're currently in an El Nino system, which means we're getting some rain, but they say even if we get this kind of rain for months, we're still gonna be in a drought. And in some municipalities, they have taken to publishing the lists of the heaviest water users. And clearly not you, but and not me either. But we will get these lists of here are the people in the community who have used the most water. Now, of course, they're paying for that water, paying a lot, but it is this phenomenon of drought shaming which seems not too far away from painting a blue circle on someone's door and saying, you know, they are a water thief. How close do you think we could get in our society, and this is again talking about the nature of democracy and the nature of this government that many of us live in around the world, not quite a democracy in the UK, but and maybe not quite a democracy here soon, but how close to, let's not get political, but how close do you think we could get to the point where water crime would be a reality if droughts lasted? I mean, that seemed far off in reading your books, and then I realized, no, we're not.
I think I saw you write about this somewhere else, just that the question is whether water is a human right and whether it belongs to the public commons or not, which I think is
Can you steal water?
What's that?
Yeah, can water be really stolen, or is it a right? Is it something that doesn't belong to anyone? I mean, that is actually a passage in your book, that the water does not belong to you.
No, because I think in my book, the at least some of the characters feel that natural resources are not something that you can own anyway. They are something that you can try to claim ownership of, but you are never going to succeed with that. I certainly hope that we don't see the kind of society that I've imagined in my book, because that would be horrible. But the truth is that control over natural resources has always been used to control people, and that control over natural resources has always also triggered conflicts. So I don't think it's entirely impossible. I certainly hope that we don't see. But I mean, even I think I met a reader in the UK who had grown up in Lebanon, which went through a period of civil war, and she said that when she read my book, she was reminded of that, because there were serious water shortages in Lebanon at the time, and water became like that. You could there were such things as water crimes, so. I don't think it's impossible at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have much to add to that. I think it's a fascinating conversation. The market economy is pretty able to handle a lot of things. I mean, there's a certain amount of self-regulation that happens, but in the case of something like this, where it's absolutely necessary to survival, it's a finite resource, I could certainly understand why people would back publishing those names in the paper. It's that becomes a very tricky issue, and you have
it's a tricky issue, as you said. Are either or both of you aware of the water issue going on in Flint, Michigan right now? There's contaminated water. And it reminded me of questions of government intervention, and is the government doing good, or could the government be behind this problem? You know, what do you think the situation there, you know, now you can put on your government hat. Do you have any, this is a question from the audience, by the way, if you can comment on that and where you see any solution there.
I don't think I know enough about the situation there to be able to answer that, to be honest. I've read a little bit about it, but I don't feel that I have enough information.
Okay.
Yeah, it's that's such a great question, and I think it ties in really well with what we were just talking about. In short, there's a public water system, incredible quantities of lead in the system, and there's been horrible amounts of poisoning, essentially, for the whole community. And another thing that another event that happened several years ago, which was like scarily, freakily close to how my book, what happened in my book, was the Detroit Water Brigade. I don't know if people remember that, but Detroit decided to cut off huge swaths of water service to neighborhoods because they were behind on their bills.
Yeah, I read about that.
And it was incredible. And these, you have these elderly people who suddenly do not have water coming out of their taps. But on the other hand, they, you know, all these corporations, because the water utility had not done a real good job of collecting over time, and there was huge debts built up and a lot of poverty there. And then you had also these other corporations on the side who could certainly pay their debts, but were in debt $250,000 to the water utility as well. And it was terrifying. And I think that's where you have to ask again, like, is the market system working here or not? And if it's a public life necessary resource, where does the market economy stop and where does government regulation come in? And I think in Flint, Michigan, that is, we should have a national standards body for water quality. I thought about this just as I came here. I religiously drink tap water, except for here I am. But I believe in tap water. I believe in the idea of working water systems. And when I came here to my hotel room, I just wasn't sure. I could taste that the water is different because everywhere you go, the water tastes different, which was really spoke to me about your book. And I just don't know. Can you drink the water here?
You can.
You can. Great. And that's fantastic. What's that?
I hope you can because I have been for the past 3 days.
But it's certainly, sorry, one more thing on that. Things like air pollution and water quality and the food we eat, I think we should know, that should be a wonderful task for the Silicon Valley, is to be able to instantly know the quality of those things. In our new Internet of Things economy and constant monitoring, that's a fantastic market opportunity, I think.
There should be an app for that.
There should be an app for that, yeah.
So without getting into spoilers or revealing too much for people who haven't read the books, we're actually going to talk about the way your books end. We've got an audience question here, and Emmy, we'll start with you. Did you intend for your ending to leave your readers with a positive or negative feeling about or at the end of the novel?
And this, sorry, could you repeat the question?
Did you intend for the ending to leave the reader feeling positive or negative?
I think I wanted the reader to feel a bit of both. I don't want to give away the ending, but I definitely wanted the ending to be a bit ambiguous in that sense. I wanted there to be hope, but I also didn't want it to be happy where it couldn't be happy. Let's put it that way.
And questioner also said, I loved Memory of Water. You write so descriptively, lovely imagery. So
thank you.
You go.
Thank you very much.
Ben, your ending is similar, where it is somewhat ambiguous. I think there's a moment of hope and there's a moment of not hope, perhaps. Where did you want readers to come away?
I think Emmy had a great answer. Can I just do that?
Yes, you can say that. But then I'm going to follow up and say the fate of one of your main characters at the end of your novel, and she hasn't finished it, so that's why I'm also being a little cagey. Did you reconsider how the novel would end and how the arc of one of your characters, the arc of Maid Marian, did you have any doubt how that was going to end?
Yes, I did.
Did you change or go back and forth at any point?
Yeah, I did.
Are you happy with where you ended up?
I like this. We could be talking about anything, really.
Good.
Yes or no questions only. I am happy about...
the way her story ended.
It would be really weird of me to say, I'm just totally bummed about that ending. Like, just skip the last five pages.
But speaking of the ending, another question for either or both of you is that your characters were so well developed that I would love to read more about them. Do you foresee revisiting these characters, any of them, or any of these situations in future work?
I could see myself revisiting some of the characters and the world of Memory of Water. I did briefly consider writing a sequel when I finished the book, but then I decided that it was not something I wanted to do, at least not immediately. So I've sort of filed it away for potential future projects. I can't promise that I'm going to go back into that world, but one day I might.
There's a lot of avenues where you could approach it too.
I would probably not write a sequel. I'm neck deep in another project, which I'm really enjoying. But if there are any television producers here, I think it would make a totally awesome one-season television show.
So. I think it would look great on HBO.
Personally, coming from my,
I think it would work well.
I paid her to say that. Thank you.
One of the fascinating things about both your books is that you deal very much in some specific localities, and there's a larger outside world that we don't necessarily visit as much, and in some cases we don't really know what's happening there. Do you think those would be places that you could explore in the future and give us that perspective? Because that could be an entirely different genre.
I hadn't thought about that. I think that's a brilliant idea.
There could be a lava land someplace.
That's a good point. Like in both of these places, I always wanted to go to Jingjing.
Yes.
But
you know where everything is in your book.
Yeah, I actually know where everything is. Yeah. And I would love to, I mean, if I were to ever write another story set in that world, I would love to go to the Lost Lands. I would love to see what's... you know, what's on the other continents that we don't really hear anything about, because there must be something there. I think it would be a really, for me personally, I would find it a fascinating world to explore. But like I said, maybe, maybe not.
Okay.
These are great questions, you guys.
Yeah, they're doing a better job. I should have gotten to these quicker. Let's see. In Memory of Water, why the insect hoods? I tried to imagine how they looked and what they were protecting them from. It seems like a very scary possibility.
Sorry, what was the?
The insect hoods.
Oh, the insect hoods. They kind of look like beekeeper's hats or some kind of old-fashioned mosquito net type of hats. I've actually had, because the book has been translated into 17 languages so far, I think. Quite a few translators have actually asked about the insect hood. They wanted me to send pictures so that they could get an idea of what it looks like. So I've actually got pictures of the insect hood or my idea of it filed away on my computer, so I can always send it when another translator asks.
And this connects, did you write the book in English?
I wrote it in parallel in Finnish and English. And a very brief explanation of how it works. I usually would write one chapter in Finnish first, then I would translate the chapter into English and edit while I translate it, and then I would go back and forth between the two languages until that chapter was more or less done, and then I would move on to the next chapter and do the whole thing again. So it was not a quick process.
Was there at a point where you had finished one manuscript and the other one you were just like, oh, I can't believe it, I have to do it all over?
I didn't. When I ended up with a complete manuscript, I had it in both languages. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
A couple of quick ones that you may know, you may not know. On average, do you know how much water a person uses in a day? I don't know if the person who asked this question. But did you
have
to look that up?
This feels like a trick question.
Sorry,
I believe it's 40 to 50.
How much water a person uses in a day? I mean, was that something you had to research to figure out where to bring people back?
Yeah, I'm sure I knew that at some point, but I forgot to.
Right.
217.
Sounds good. Five. They use five. And one of the, I guess, solutions out there when it comes to droughts, and if we have water shortages in the future, is to take wastewater and make it safe to drink. What do you think of that idea? Have you or would you try drinking treated water?
I think it's a great idea. But we don't necessarily have to treat it and then immediately jump to drinking it. There's lots of uses for water. we could use first. I mean, if it's a sales issue, I mean, I think treating crops with it, gardens, flushing toilets. Gray water use, probably some of you use gray water. Gray water use is pretty popular in Portland, where they will actually run pipes directly into the backs of their toilet tanks. God knows why.
I don't think it has caught on residentially here. A lot of businesses, though, have gray water pipes. Mm-hmm. They're the purple pipes. And I think last year, the mayor of San Jose, we're the 10th largest city in the country, and in the midst of this drought, he drank a glass of water from our wastewater treatment plant mm-hmm. to show people that, and not even, hey, you should drink it. It was, hey, you can put this on your plants.
Mm-hmm. And he's fine. Still mayor?
And he's still mayor. He's still alive. He's still
awesome.
Married.
That's great.
All that works. Speaking about the experience of Silicon Valley Reads, do you know what you're getting into? In a sense, the actual question is, how do you think this experience of interacting with the public at this level might influence your future writing, if at all? Will it have an influence on you as a writer?
Well, I kind of, I'm not sure if this answers exactly that question, but I kind of feel that wherever I go and whenever I see new places and I meet new people, I always pick something up that will eventually filter into my writing in some way, whether it's in characters or the setting or something else, but all of it kind of goes in there in some way. So I don't know if that's going to change me as a writer, but it might bring something into my stories that otherwise wouldn't be there.
Okay.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Silicon Valley Reads is certainly different for me because I've done book tours and I've been part of book groups, but very rarely have I interacted with so many people who in theory, you don't have to tell me, have read it beforehand. And then not only that, to do that repeatedly and to such different groups, like tomorrow I'm terrified I'm going to be presenting to a high school. I think that's really fascinating. I think I'm going to learn a lot more about the reader than I have before. I think it's really fascinating.
Speaking about research, a lot of gang elements in Sherwood Nation. Have you been part of a gang? Did you have to research guns and sort of gang tactics to make that realistic, or was that purely imagination?
I think it was mostly research. I have not been part of a gang. I was just in a photo lineup in the back room. The other incriminators were librarians. I think it was mostly research in that case. Yeah.
Well, you did a very good job.
Thank you.
And Emmy, we have a follow-up question about writing the villains. Mm-hmm. You spoke about the fun you had writing with your main villain, someone you wouldn't want to even be in the same room mm-hmm. with. Why do you think writing or reading about these deplorable characters can be so pleasurable?
Wow. This is a psychological
test.
That's
a difficult question, actually. I've never thought about why it was so much fun. I think there might be a little bit of, you can sort of, the villain characters might act as an outlet to some impulses and things that you would otherwise never even, you know. You might never say those things or do those things, but you create a character and you can sort of channel everything there.
I think it's great wish fulfillment in some ways, I guess. I've heard actors say the same thing. They love playing villains because you get to do the worst things, but it's okay because
it's
just
fiction. Yeah. It's a very safe place to play with things that might otherwise be threatening.
And only nominally related, my daughter has a best friend who has a stuffed animal who has what is more or less like Tourette's syndrome, and that stuffed animal is just horrid. Like, it treats both of them horribly, and yet it's this girl who voices the character, and she's the sweetest girl, and I think it's that. It's that outlet for
all the dog.
We gossip about that stuffed animal all the time. It's like, oh, God, I can't believe the language. Sorry.
No, that's probably going to be the best anecdote of this whole thing. And clearly, in writing deplorable characters, you found, I think you did channel a little bit of your working for the governor into some of your civil servants. That must have been a little cathartic for you to be writing about government in that way. Now, and this question's more coming from me, what did you think about the media in terms, well, both of you have different elements of media and technology and communication in your books. How did, you know, how much thought did you put into how people would be communicating and how news would be disseminated?
I did think about that quite a lot, actually, because it being a future world that doesn't have the same resources available as we have, we tend to take a lot of technology, communication technology, for granted. But if you remove some natural resources like oil and some minerals, you're not really left with very much. So I actually had to put quite a lot of thought into what kind of devices would even be possible in this world, and then once we know that, how would they be used? In Memory of Water, communication technology is very much based on recycled materials, and it's very much used not just for communication, but also for controlling people. It's kind of something that the military government gives the people, assigns, and then they use it to control people.
Yeah, I thought about it a lot too. I mean, first of all, in Sherwood Nation, because of the dearth of power for the majority of the day, media was reduced to very small bytes, and those bytes were very powerful because it was the way that the city communicated with itself. It was the city's own feedback mechanism. And because of the power that they had then, they could make or break people. And I liked that idea. I liked playing with the idea of something that we all experience now in this age, which is that we have our own impressions of ourselves, and then we present a different impression of ourselves, a different facet of ourselves on social media. And then sometimes there's a third characteristic where sometimes social media will get out of control, out of your control, and a third sort of public inputted facet of yourself is presented. And in the case of Renee and Maid Marian, she was very much altered by who the media portrayed her as. Mm-hmm. And it became ingrained in her and part of her own. I mean, it was certainly the seeds of that were there, but it was also the media that in part created her.
That is what we do in media, that is our...
Well, yes, right.
That is our job. We create heroes and then we
thank you.
Tear them right down. And given that both of you wrote your books not yesterday, not in the past year or two, you started yours in 2008, I think you said. And Ben, when did you start Sherwood Nation?
Right about the same time.
Okay.
Yep.
So a lot has happened in the world politically, ecologically. We probably know a little bit more now than we did nearly a decade ago. Is there anything that you would change about what you wrote, given where you see the world going now and think, oh, in some ways the world has overtaken my fiction, or do you still see it as a solid path?
Yeah, I stand behind everything I wrote at the time because I can't really see that anything has changed to contradict anything in the book. If anything, I feel that the book seems more timely now than it did at the time because of the droughts, because of the sea level rise, because we keep getting more news about climate change and what is going on with it. I feel that I wouldn't change anything about the book now.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would change anything either, and that might be in part just laziness and being interested in other projects. But I mean, I think that's such an interesting question. I'm not sure that there's anything in my book that I didn't set out necessarily to predict the future.
No, neither did I.
Yeah, exactly. But certainly I think there are elements of the present that could lead to either of the futures that we created. And I think that's one really interesting thing that a person writing science fiction can do is to create sort of a decision branching tree of future possibilities for us all to look at and to think on. Like, what, you know, if it's like a programming equation, if this, then that. If we continue at this rate, here's one possible future that could happen. And I think that's kind of a wonderful power and part of the reason to write science fiction.
Yeah, I would add to that I think also science fiction is many times not even about trying to predict the future, but it's also a lot of the time just trying to reflect the present world as it is, through imagining a different kind of future world, if that makes sense.
It does, and let's look at this future world quickly and have one last question. What is in the future for the two of you? What are you working on now? What can you tell us?
Yes, I'm working on a book about, takes place entirely at an archaeological dig. I mean, that's part of the fun of writing is that you find yourself passionate about things and you can just pursue it to its very end. And I became very intrigued and interested in archaeology, especially in Oregon, where some of the very oldest finds for human inhabitants on these two continents, North and South America, have been found. And I find it just incredibly fascinating. So I'm spending a lot of time at an archaeological dig, playing with the characters there, playing with the subject matter, playing with tribe interaction with archaeologists, things like that. And it's not, my first book had fantastical elements, this one had sci-fi elements, and this one has neither, so.
Great. Mm-hmm. And Demi, what are you working on?
I have just finished my second novel, which is coming out as The Weaver in the US in May, I think. It's a fantasy book rather than a science fiction novel, and it's about an island where dreaming is forbidden. And so that's where I finished. Now I'm gonna take a small break while I'm here in Silicon Valley, and then after that I'm gonna think about what to do next. It might be a space opera or it might be another ecological science fiction story. I haven't decided yet.
Great. Well, I look forward to finding out all of these, the archaeology, the place where you can't dream. But thank you for taking part in our program tonight. We look forward to hearing from you again and finding out what your Silicon Valley Reads adventure is like. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to the audience.